Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. For those of you who will be doing some traveling and possibly getting some negative impact to your health because of it, especially long flights, good news, a simple berry can make a difference from Griffith University. A common chemical may act together to increase cancer risk. Well, we don't want that. So from Oregon State University, we'll show you what to do to protect yourself and help prevent some cancers, hopefully a lot of cancers. From University of Pittsburgh School of Public Health, menopause is associated with what? Never heard of this before. Raising the risk of heart disease? Well, let's save some lives today. We love to empower. We'll share that. And from University of Missouri, blood vessels can actually get better with age? Well, that's good. We've got a lot of good information of how to extend the quality of life. Also, the DSM highlights new study to assess the role of vitamin E in treating common liver conditions, University Medical Center in Germany. So vitamin E and a healthier liver, and migraines are linked to certain heavy metals and mineral deficiencies. We'll share that with you. And non-toxic options for parents not wanting to vaccinate. Well, I've gotten a lot of people asking me about this, so today, get your notepad ready. I'm going to share with you something that is safe, non-toxic, and actually effective in protecting you and your family, and it's a natural way to vaccinate. Plus, time permitting, eating fish is not good. I'll tell you why, and other issues on health. I'm going to spend extra time today with my guest. It'll be a continuation of our conversations with remarkable minds. That guest is one of the most progressive thinkers in the area of social issues, economics. He is Professor Paul Craig Roberts, and he has got a lot to say. I'm going to be asking about Greece because most people think, okay, that's behind us now. They got their bailout. Everything's cool. No, it's not. And I'm concerned that the average person doesn't understand the full dimensions of the problem and what's really behind it. They could have bailed Greece out. They could have forgiven their debt. They could have bought the debt by printing more money, much like the Federal Reserve gave banks and quantitative easing. Why didn't they do that? What is the motive? Professor Paul Craig Roberts, I'll probably spend a half hour with him. Also, I'm going to focus on something that Wesley Clark said, and I'll play the segment where he said it, the idea that he wants internment camps for radicalized Americans, and I'm going to have you call in on our talkback and share your thoughts. I remember when he was on Democracy Now! Making statements, but he wasn't challenged on what he said. I'm going to challenge this. Also, recovery. What recovery? If you're a child in America, the latest on how bad it is. And also today, I've been talking about this since ABC Network that I was on, implanting chips, what are called RFID chips, in people. It's being done. Who's going to tell us about it? Give us an example. The BBC. Also, a few comments about how they're getting by in Haiti, and how the Red Cross is partly responsible, as well as Clinton and all these NGOs, non-governmental organizations, that have made billions off the suffering of Haitians. I remember just about 5-6 months ago, there was a major demonstration in Harlem up on 125th Street, and I went up to give support because I have pretty good knowledge of what's going on in Haiti and am doing what I can to help the people of Haiti. And I was appalled that I was the only person from our sister station, WBAI, the only journalist who was there. And yet there were hundreds of people demonstrating outside of Bill Clinton's office. In any case, I'll share some thoughts on Haiti and how Anyone who can make a buck off their suffering is making it, and they're not being called out. We'll call them out today. Let's begin. We have a lot to share. One of nature's great healing berries is the elderberry, E-L-D-E-R-B-E-R-R-Y. This is from Griffith University. Quote, "The negative health effects of international air travel are well documented, but now it seems that the common elderberry can provide some relief." Two professors at Griffith's Menzies Health Institute in Queensland have completed a clinical trial showing that elderberry supplements, by the way, it's a liquid, you would drink it, and tastes something like black currants, a little on the kind of pungent side, but it's terrific for you. And we know that it can provide protection from colds and flu-like symptoms, but especially if you're on those long hauls. So we know we have a lot of pilots and flight attendants listening to this program, because I do an awful lot of flying, and I'm always being told, oh, I listened to your show. And then I try to give whatever advice I can of how to keep from varicosity, stroke, different conditions they're more likely to have, and die sooner if you're a pilot or a flight attendant, which is a fact. So now, presenting this at the International Medical Conference in Melbourne, this was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled clinical trial conducted with 312 economy class passengers traveling from Australia to an overseas destination. And then they measured all of the different symptoms and problems, how long. Quote, "We found that most cold episodes occurred in the placebo group." And why? Because the elderberry protects. We're not talking about a lot. 300 milligrams, that's a half a teaspoon. This was published in the journal Current Therapeutic Research. It also showed that it works in combination with echinacea, which is important too. So when you're taking a flight, let's say a flight of more than 2 hours, take a teaspoon of elderberry extract. Now, from Oregon State University, we find out that, quote, "common environmental chemicals assumed to be safe at low doses." No, they're not. Why? Because they act together to disrupt human tissues in ways that eventually lead to cancer. That's according to nearly 200 scientists from 28 countries, including one from Oregon State University. In this 3-year investigation of the state of knowledge about environmentally influenced cancers, the scientists studied low-dose effects of 85 common chemicals now considered to be carcinogenic in humans. The researchers reviewed the action of these chemicals separately. Now, here's where it gets complicated. If you use a low dose of these separately, you're not likely to create a cancer. Hence, the FDA, the USDA, the EPA will say it's not a carcinogen. But the moment you combine it, it becomes a carcinogen. Now, here's one of the arguments that I've had many times in debates with heads of different industries, the meat industry, the dairy industry, the toiletry industry, the refined confectioners industry, the saccharin industry. I've debated them all. And their argument is, well, where's the proof? Are they using the same argument the tobacco industry did? Here's the proof. They've examined all the studies, 85 chemicals, and they find that, quote, "to show that they disrupt functioning of cells in ways that correlated with known early patterns of cancer, even at the low dose, presumably benign levels at which most people are exposed." And then some of them are very high carcinogens. Quote, "our findings also suggest these molecules may be acting in synergy to increase cancer activity." So what can we do about this? And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Carcinogenesis. We can do several things. First and foremost, take an honest look at your living and working environment. What can you do to get rid of particle boards, carpets that would have formaldehyde, cleaning materials that you use in your sink or garage or bathrooms that outgas and you're not even aware of it? Even things as simple as plastic water bottles that you don't think about refrigerating, and as a result, they're left out. And I even know people that carry them in their cars and then drink, not realizing when you turn off the air conditioner, that car temperature can go up to 110, 120 degrees easily. And the chemicals that are in that plastic bottle leach into the water. You won't see it. You won't necessarily even taste it. But your cells will respond to it. Being able to put fresh plants into our homes, hanging plants are particularly good. Spider plants are great. The ivies are terrific for absorbing these toxins. When we paint, use a non-toxic paint. When you want to seal something, use a natural resin. Now, there are natural resins that will give you a nice shine, clean. If I clean glass, I use apple cider vinegar. No toxin, and it cleans just as well as any of the commercial products. You can use what are called free and clear biodegradable detergents. It is the fragrances that are carcinogenic. So stay away from fragrances unless they are natural, 100% natural essential oil fragrances. Organic produce. Stay away from synthetic materials. Try to go with cottons and wools, wood, but wood that is not pressed or chemically treated. And you will reduce tremendously the amount of those chemicals that in synergy are carcinogenic from getting into your body. Now, from the University of Pittsburgh School of Public Health Sciences, published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism, late and postmenopausal women have significantly greater volumes of fat around their hearts, which means a risk factor for heart disease. Well, quote, cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death in women. It increases after the age of 50, the average age when a woman is going through menopause. By showing that menopause appears to be associated with a shift in fat deposits that leads to more fat around the heart, we uncovered a new potential contributor to increased risk of cardiovascular disease in women. Okay, what is the positive solution? I'm glad to know this because we didn't know this. We knew there was greater fat accumulation in the belly, the hips, the thighs, around the spleen, and around the liver and the kidneys. We did not know about around the heart. So what we do is power walk 1 hour a day. Reduce the amount of fat to around 12 to 14, 15% maximum. Then take those nutrients that are lipogenesis, meaning they're going to burn fat in the body, like conjugated linoleic acids, and also take something to protect the heart, like coenzyme Q10, L-carnitine, mixed tocopherols and tocotrienols, magnesium. Also, from the University of Missouri, study finds that arteries adapt to oxidative stress caused by aging. Hence, blood vessels can actually get better with age. And, quote, although the causes of many age-related diseases remain unknown, oxidative stress is thought to be a main culprit. Oxidative stress has been linked to cardiovascular and neurodegenerative diseases, including diabetes, hypertension, and age-related cancers. However, researchers at the University of Missouri recently found that aging actually offered significant protection against oxidative stress. These findings suggest that aging may trigger an adaptive response to counteract the effect of oxidative stress on blood vessels. Quote, molecules known as reactive oxygen species, or ROS, play an important role in regulating cellular function. And, however, the overproduction of ROS can help create a condition referred to as oxidative stress, which can alter the functioning of cells and interfere with their growth and reproduction. We studied the endothelium from resistance arteries of male mice for 24 months, corresponding to humans in the early 30s and through mid-60s, and they found that they can be protected. Right, well, how do we learn from this? In lay language, what does this mean for us? You've heard me mention many times on this program, endothelium. Endothelium is the lining of your arteries. When that is healthy, your arteries are pliable. You won't have damage to them, lesions. You won't have impaction of cholesterol, ceroid pigments, and calcification that blocks your arteries, increasing blood pressure, and the likelihood of that will break off and create a clot. Hence, the health of your endothelium allows you to live a longer life and reduces your chance of heart attacks. What can help the endothelium? Living foods, juices, greens detoxifying chelate, so they're really important for your arteries. Celery, cucumber, parsley, kale, collard greens, watercress, all good for your arteries. But then there are nutrients that are known to heal the epithelium. Top of the list, pomegranate. There's no single fruit that will do more for your arteries than pomegranate. So eating pomegranates, good. Drinking the unsweetened juice, great. Having the concentrations, terrific. Or the powder, the best. But get your pomegranate, protect your heart, lower your fat, and exercise. And also from the University Medical Center in Germany, a major study showing that vitamin E can help the common liver conditions people suffer from. And the most common liver condition, which is epidemic, is non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And that is a killer. How do you get this? We know how we get cirrhosis and liver fibrosis, but how to, and hepatocellular carcinoma, we get it by eating sugar, including a lot of fructose. So give up the fructose. If you want something that's sweet, use a natural, non-caloric sweetener like stevia. That can make a difference. And then take your vitamin E at 400 units in the morning and 400 in the afternoon or before you go to bed at night. That's the latest on health and healing. Now this is from Sarah Lazar from Common Dreams. Quote, there are roughly 3 million more children living in poverty today in the United States than during the outbreak of the Great Recession 2008. And the so-called economic recovery has bypassed children of color altogether. The 2015 data book released yesterday by the Baltimore-based Annie E. Casey Foundation evaluates information from numerous federal agencies and determines child well-being nationwide. The report finds that, listen carefully to this, quote, approximately 22% of all children in the United States live beneath the poverty line. Wow. And 31% of children had parents without secure employment. So the recession has passed by all these children. That's an awful lot of children. So what are we hearing in the national media? What are we seeing in reports and documentaries? How about nothing? Not a word. Now, what would happen if we went up to, let's say, Park Avenue, and from 96th Street down to downtown, we had outside of the building every day 28% of all the children on Park Avenue were begging for food? Would you think anyone would do a story on it? You bet. And you wouldn't have to have 28%. It'd be considered a crisis. But if you have 28% of Black and Latino children, it's a non-issue. That is unfortunate, and we shouldn't tolerate it. We also should be very conscious of Wesley Clark. This is from The Intercept, from Hussein. Quote, retired general and former Democratic presidential candidate, by the way, a darling of Pacifica, Wesley Clark on Friday called for World War II-style internment camps to be revived for, quote, disloyal Americans. In an interview on MSNBC's Thomas Roberts in the wake of a mass shooting, Clark said that during World War II, quote, if someone supported Nazi Germany at the expense of the United States, we didn't say that was freedom of speech, we put him in a camp. They were prisoners of war. He called for a revival of internment camps to help combat extremism. Quote, if these people are radicalized, they don't support the United States, and they're disloyal to the United States as a matter of principle, it's their right, and it's our right and obligation to segregate them from the normal community for the duration of the conflict. End quote. Okay, let's see. Let's say that you're considered radicalized. Let me think. Bonnie Faulkner, with her program Guns and Butter. Virtually all of her guests that I've heard, and she would be in an internment camp. Bonnie and I together, at the behest of KPFA, the Pacifica station in Berkeley, would consider us radicalized because they don't even want us to know, they don't want to know what we have to say. They assume that what we say is so radical that the listeners couldn't determine whether it benefited them or not when talking about vaccines. So they're pro-vaccine. So anyone who's against vaccines would be radicalized. So then they would support, I guess, internment camps for all of the physicians, Tony Bark, all the parents of autistic children or children who were normal until they got vaccinated, and that's about 2 million. So let's make room for 2 million parents who are radicalized because they're radicalized against the medical-industrial complex and not having freedom of choice. That's also, well, of course, all the Occupy Wall Street, that's radicalized. We got to definitely make room for Chris Hedges. And who else? Well, let's say about 2,000 progressive thinkers. Now, it's interesting because when you Google liberal radio, we come up number one. When you Google progressive radio, we're number one in the world. So I guess our listeners, for supporting radicalization of thought, should be put into an internment camp. Oh, by the way, there's a big difference, night and day, between liberal and progressive. We represent progressives and not the corporate and typical liberal, the Clinton, the Nation, and Mother Jones, who would consider much of what we do radicalized. So think of all the people that would be put into internment camps. But let's listen to what he had to say in his own words.
Generally, you know, a lot of people would say you reap what you sow. So how do we fix self-radicalized lone wolves domestically?
Well, we've got to identify the people who are most likely to be radicalized. We've got to cut this off at the beginning. There are always a certain number of young people who are alienated. They don't get a job. They lost a girlfriend. Their family doesn't feel happy here. Mm-hmm. And we can watch the signs of that. And there are members of the community who will reach out to those people and bring them back in. But I do think on a national policy level, we need to look at what self-radicalization means, because we are at war with this group of terrorists. They do have an ideology. In World War II, if someone supported Nazi Germany at the expense of the United States, we didn't say that was freedom of speech. We put him in a camp. They were prisoners of war. So if these people are radicalized and they don't support the United States and they're disloyal to the United States as a matter of principle, fine, that's their right. It's our right and our obligation to segregate them from the normal community for the duration of the conflict. And I think we're going to have to increasingly get tough on this, not only in the United States, but our allied nations.
Okay, so, by the way, think of the hundreds of thousands of Japanese who did nothing, didn't protest, didn't make an anti-American statement. They were put into the internment camps. And think of now that the Patriot Act and the National Defense Authorization Act already gives the President of the United States the right to assassinate at will with no repercussions, no trial, no jury, no habeas corpus, nothing. So it's not good enough that the people in power can do anything they want to anyone they want at any time for any reason. And now the National Security Agency has been shown to be spying on corporations all over the world for the benefit of corporate people that they're close to. But now the idea that just being radical, which means thinking differently, living differently, acting differently, And already the FBI has shown that people that protest the environment, animal rights, are considered domestic terrorists, hence radicalized. Your thoughts, call us 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. And that was a darling of the Democratic group. While we're waiting for your calls, here's what billions of dollars in aid to Haiti, $500 million, I have a billion, to the Red Cross alone to build 106,000 homes, but they only built six homes, not 106,000, six. But those NGOs, they're loaded to the gills with money, power, and they're all inside a collective group. But the Haitian people, well, they're eating mud cookies. Literally, mud cookies.
They look a lot like pancakes or cookies. The recipe passed down from generations here in Haiti. Women spend entire days making them. Grandmothers, daughters, and younger girls. Infants are nursed while mothers work the mix. Kids seem to enjoy them, at least when our camera was around. But these patties, known as bonbon terres by the Haitians who eat them, are a grim reminder of just how poor this Caribbean nation is. They aren't sweet, they're hard to swallow, and add almost nothing in terms of nutrition, because the cookies are actually made of dirt.
It fills your stomach. When we haven't eaten anything, this dirt cookie fills your stomach.
Traded, sold, and even hoarded by women, here in the poorest section of the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, Cité Soleil in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Small amounts of vegetable shortening, salt, and occasionally sugar are mixed in with the dirt and water as well, made in places like this, an old fort where torture was once common by corrupt dictators here. Fort Dimanche is now a center of commerce built around the dirt cookies, a basketball court, soccer field, and school for hundreds of kids, and home to many. To get to the basketball court, which acts as a preparation area for the dirt cookies, you have to cross this open sewer, which is littered with animal parts and trash and other nasty things, to get to an area where the cookies are laid out to dry out in the sun. You can see that these are still very wet, not quite ready to be served, but this is literally dirt being prepared for humans to eat on top of other dirt and filth. Céline Denis' life revolves around the cookies. For days we watched as the grandmother sat mixing the dirt cookie batter. Selling the cookies is Denis' sole source of income and often her only food.
It's a necessary evil. I'm in a bad situation, and that's why I make them. It hurts my heart, but I have no choice. We're forced to eat it. It makes us sick, but not the way it would to anybody who's not used to eating it. Our system is kind of used to it.
The dirt is trucked into this huge slum and sold at an enormous markup to the women, who pay about $5 a sack. They say it comes from an area in the mountains and are convinced the dirt is rich in minerals and vitamins. And if they don't have the money, they're happy, indeed eager to buy the dirt on credit.
Billions of dollars. It goes to the Clinton Friends and Foundations. It goes to the NGOs. It doesn't provide food. The Haitian people, they're left to eat mud. Just remember that the next time one of these clowns get on television and ask you to give the Red Cross money. Let's say hello to Van from Southern California. Your turn, Van. You're on the air.
Yes, Gary. I was in World War II and had the pleasure of voting for Henry Wallace when I got out of the service. I can't ever recall ever hearing that anyone who espoused Nazism during the war was put in a concentration camp. Do you know of any?
I knew that they put Eugene Debs in prison for his political views, but he was a progressive.
He was classified him as a communist.
Yes. Anyone who listened to truth from a different perspective was labeled as a communist, and we had McCarthyism, and he was
chief cheerleader. I'm well aware of that, but I think the general just doesn't really know what he's talking about when he makes the statement that they put him in jail and put in prison.
Just imagine how many people would fit in jail if you were put in jail for being radicalized.
Yeah, well, right? I'm one of them.
Well, thank you, and of course, we would have the first place in line.
Okay.
I appreciate your call. We're going to take a quick break and come back. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Joining us from Northern Georgia for our interview segment is Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. He is one of today's most progressive political and economic writers and commentators on the state of the nation, government dysfunction, political corruption, global and domestic economic threats, the war on terror, Wall Street, and the decline in human values in American society. He was the chairman of the Institute for Political Economy. He was a former Assistant Secretary of Treasury under Ronald Reagan's first term. And during his academic career, he taught at many universities and held the William Simon Chair in Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Georgetown University. He has a blog, can be found at paulcraigroberts.org. He's a frequent contributor to Global Research, The Trends Journal, Counterpunch, and others. And he was an associate editor at The Wall Street Journal. He's published many books, including his latest, How America Was Lost, from 9/11 to the police warfare state. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary.
I'm going to ask you to paint a large picture for us with specific points of reference. I want to start with Greece because, for most Americans, the Greek issue is no longer important. All right, they are getting their bailout over a period of time. Some state up to 80 billion euros, and that'll be parceled out only when they do certain things, like they have to cut more jobs, more pensions. They have to make people become even more accepting of an austerity program, meaning there's going to be a lot less quality of life and a lot more suffering. Oh, and they also want to set aside $50 billion in actual tangible assets. So if for any reason this doesn't work, those people who are powerful enough, the oligarchs, the major people, can come in and take over these major assets. They want to privatize ports, all the shipping, the roads, water, gas, electricity. In other words, everything that anyone would use that may now not cost them anything or very little, you'll pay for. And this is with a group of people that are already very scarce on anything, including food. So now we've been told it's okay. The European Union, led by Germany and France and the United Kingdom, said, you pay up. We're not taking a haircut. We're not giving a discount. And they went, the Greek people said, no, we don't want any more austerity. We voted on a referendum. And the Greek prime minister comes back and says, but we have to do what they want or the banks won't open and it'll get a lot worse. And there's no other option. That's it. Now, they're going to go ahead with this. And we're supposed to believe that that's going to stabilize the Eurozone. Now, before you answer that, I came across some very important and statistically accurate information about the bankruptcy of the planet accelerating. 24 nations are currently facing a debt crisis. Some of these nations have a greater debt to their gross domestic product, their income, than does Greece. We're looking at countries that we don't hear a word about, like Armenia, Belize, Costa Rica, Croatia, Cyprus, Dominican Republic, El Salvador, Gambia, Grenada, Ireland, Jamaica, Lebanon, Marshall Islands, Montenegro, Portugal, Spain, Sri Lanka, St. Vincent's, Tunisia, Ukraine, Sudan, Zimbabwe. And then there are 14 nations that are right at the verge of being bankrupt. Bhutan, Cape Verde, Dominica, Ethiopia, Ghana, Laos, Mauritania, Mongolia, Mozambique, Somalia, Senegal, Tanzania, and Uganda, who likely will join them. Now, for example, Spain's debt to their gross domestic product has risen to 98%. Italy's debt is now 132%. France is right up there. It's virtually bankrupt at 95%. So in addition to Spain and Italy and France, don't forget Belgium, 106% debt to their gross domestic product. Ireland is 109% debt, and Portugal is 130%. So if we were honest and we took a look, you're looking at trillions of dollars of debt that these countries owe. Are we now going to see them going through the same type of austerity programs, or is there any other way of looking at this than what we've been told? And finally, when the Greek public was told, you pay back this debt you owe, some $300 billion, and no one says, did we actually receive $300 billion? Did it come into Greece? Did it benefit the Greek public or infrastructure? And the answer, of course, is no. You only got about 12% of it. And then you, the public, didn't get it, but the banks did. The rest of it is the magic of economic alchemy. So you're going to pay back debt that you never received, that could be forgiven but won't be, and now struggle. That's where we have left this story. Please pick it up and paint us the larger picture.
Well, Gary, you described it, I think. You know, the United States debt as a share of GDP is larger than the countries you mentioned. And so why isn't the United States among the bankrupt crowd? It probably is the most indebted of all. And, of course, the answer is that we have our own currency. And so we can pay off the debt by printing dollars and buying back the bonds. And that's the trouble with Greece. They don't have their currency, and therefore they can't print currency to buy back their bonds. That's the trouble being in the EU and using the euro. It means you are not sovereign. You don't have your own money. Now, the Greek crisis is really not about debt. That's a cover. What the so-called Greek crisis is about is establishing two new principles. One is that creditors are not responsible when they make bad loans. Instead of the banks having to absorb the cost of their own mistakes, they can impose their mistakes on the population of the country to whose government the banks overlent. This is a new principle. The other new principle that's being established inside the EU is that the so-called sovereign debt problem is being used to centralize political authority. What the so-called bailouts do is to take away the Greek government's control over its own fiscal policy. It can no longer set its spending priorities, its taxes, but must accept what is handed to them from the EU. So that's what's really going on. These two new principles that creditors can force the people of a country to make good on the creditors' mistakes. And the governments of the member states of the EU have to sacrifice their sovereignty over fiscal policy to the EU. So that's what it's about, and that's why the Greeks could get no mercy, no goodwill, no accommodation from the EU, because they want to establish these two principles. So that's what it's all about. And of course, the 1% can take advantage of the argument that the people have to make good the bank's mistakes in order to loot the country. And so the public assets that are set apart are not some sort of conditional thing. They have to be sold in order to come up with cash to pay part of the debt. So it's a looting process that's covered by this new principle that the people are responsible for banks' mistakes. And it's the subordination of member state governments to the EU. It's another centralization, a further erosion of the sovereignty of the member states. The same thing will happen to Italy, Spain, Portugal. It's already happened to Ireland. They tried to impose it on Iceland, but they didn't succeed. So only tiny little Iceland has survived this onslaught. The long list of countries you mentioned, these are small, powerless states. They may have some resources that the 1% wants to loot. And therefore, they've been drawn up as targets so that the looting that's prescribed for Greece can be used to deprive these countries also of their national patrimony.
There are a few issues I would like clarity on, if you would, please. One is that when we looked carefully at the actual amount of money that was transferred into Greece, whether it ended up in infrastructure, paying for the payroll of the government employees, the maximum that could be found was only 12% or less. That means that the vast majority of this debt that they're told to repay never ended up going to Greece. Could you explain how this is not the first time this has happened? This has happened with the World Bank structural adjustments, and they're building giant complexes in countries that serve the interest of the people that control the flow of money, but it never got to the actual people in the country, though they later had to pay astronomical interest and principal back for money that never got there, never benefited them, got somewhere, benefited someone. And it looks like the same is true of Greece. Could you explain this to us?
Yeah, well, you know, John Perkins explains this looting mechanism in The Confessions of an Economic Hitman. That book came out somewhere around 2005 or 2006. He was actually a participant in the process and describes it. And in the case of Greece, I don't know what the percentage is. You said 12%. I have no idea what percentage of the money actually ended up in Greece. But I do know that much of the money that was lent to Greek governments happened in the following way, so to speak. A German bank would come to the Greek government and say, hey, don't you want to borrow a few billion euros, and you can use them to buy German submarines for your navy.
They bought two.
And by the way, here's a bag full of money under the table to agree to this. And so the Greek government would, not the current government, but, you know, many of the previous governments,
the colonels,
extremely corrupt and very much aligned with money and interest. So the government would say, oh, good, we need these submarines. I mean, Turkey, Cyprus, the Americans want us to have more defense spending so we can help them cause trouble for the Russians. Yes, lend us the billions of euros and we'll buy German submarines. So you're right. The money didn't go to Greece. It went to the manufacturers of German submarines. So Greece was just part of the laundry mechanism that Greece ended up taking the burden of the debt that was used to benefit Germany. And for doing that, the Greek government received a bag full of money. I mean the officials who approved the loan. Those few people received bagpulls money for, it was a bribe, it was a payoff. And much of the debt was accumulated in that way. And that is why I think that the Greek Parliament released that report recently, that the Greek, that the debt was fraudulent and immoral and not worthy of being repaid. And they're right. So it comes back to the fact that much of the indebtedness was originated by the banks themselves, who paid bribes to Greek government officials to indebt the country in order to benefit manufacturers and banks in other countries. So that is the situation.
If you were to look at this pragmatically, and we use Greece to compare to the United States, during the period of 2007-08 up until just a year ago, a total of between $16 to $21 trillion, 16 minimum, 21 maximum, was given, much of it secretly, to Citicorp, JP Morgan Chase, but also foreign banks and Goldman Sachs. $888 billion was given to Goldman Sachs at virtually zero interest. And also, not only did we give these companies that had made enormous mistakes and caused the recession money, we also took back bad debt, meaning their worst, most toxic liabilities the Federal Reserve took, supposedly as some form of collateral, and of course those are immediately junked. Now, that was considered good business for Wall Street, and all of the financial advisors like Larry Summers and Timothy Geithner and Ben Bernanke all suggested if we didn't do this, that we could have a major meltdown. So if it works for the United States, plus upwards hidden of about $130 billion per month, noted $89 billion per month, up from $64 billion per month in quantitative easing, again, giving these companies money at no interest, then why could they not, at the same time, the European Central Bank, which can print money and control the value of that, why couldn't they, along with the International Monetary Fund and the European Union, why couldn't they forgive all of the debt, or why couldn't they turn around and pay the creditors of this so that Greece starts off just like Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan and Citi, all of those would have gone bankrupt. Why couldn't they be given the same clean bill of health to start without going through this torturous austerity program that will not work, and even the International Monetary Fund acknowledged it won't work?
Well, that's easy to answer, Gary. First of all, the European Central Bank is really not allowed to create money in support of member states' debt, but nevertheless has begun doing so. So its charter is a dead letter law. And you're absolutely correct. There's nothing in the way of the European Central Bank from purchasing the outstanding Greek government debt or purchasing enough of it that Greece is able to service the remainder. In other words, the European Central Bank can purchase Greek debt just as the Federal Reserve purchased the mortgage-backed securities from the big banks. So, yes, they could do that. Except, as I said at the beginning of the show, it's not the debt that's the issue. The debt is being used for two other purposes. One, to centralize authority over Greece and the other member states in the EU Commission, and to establish the fact that creditors are not responsible when they make bad loans. So since those principles are what's important to the 1%, to the EU Central Bank, they have studiously avoided the easy way out, which would be to purchase enough of the outstanding Greek debt that the Greek government could service the remainder.
What would be another exit strategy for Greece? What if it decided to go through taking the poison pill, getting out of the euro, as England has? England's part of the European Union but has its own currency, and try to reestablish its own currency, privatize one bank that would be the state bank that it could control lending, borrowing, and loans at low interest. Why couldn't they suggest that, since they would have some trading partners already within the BRIC nations, India and Russia and China, South Africa and Brazil, and other countries who have stated they're willing to trade with them, work with them, so the Greek people do not starve to death, have food, and would be able to lower the price of their goods sold so that they would be competitive in the world market? Why not even consider that?
Well, conceptually, the Greeks could leave the euro, revive their own currency, but they don't have any strong currencies or any gold stock with which to defend their new currency, and it would quickly be driven to nothing.
Naked shorting.
By currency speculators. They would be punished. The European Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, they would. So the Greeks would have to not permit their currency to be traded. They would have to keep it off. It would have to be a closed currency for Greeks, so they wouldn't have a way of paying for imports. Now, it's possible that they could come to an agreement with Russia and possibly China, that they could get some financing from those countries and perhaps from the new BRICS bank, and that they would be able to have enough stronger currencies to reissue their own, or simply to keep their currency blocked from currency markets and to use the monies that are provided from the BRICS or Russia or China to pay for the imports. Now, that's possible. It would take a lot of careful preparation. It takes time and intelligence and cooperation of the major BRICS countries. In my view, Washington would never permit that, because if Greece leaves the EU, they leave NATO. And the temptation for Italy, Spain, and Portugal to follow would be very great. For the Russians and Chinese, it's a good deal. It would mean the unraveling of NATO, and therefore it would be more difficult for Washington to bring conflict to Russia and China. And therefore, Washington knows this. So if it were to look like the inflexibility of the EU toward Greece, the inflexibility of the German government toward Greece, was going to produce a Greek departure, what would happen is Washington would call up the Germans and the EU and read them the Riot Act and say, under no conditions will we tolerate Greece leaving the EU. So you, Mr. Draghi, at the European Central Bank, roll out printing presses and buy up the Greek debt, or else. And Washington then would force the EU to accommodate the Greeks by taking up some share of the debt such that the remainder is serviceable.
Final question. What is the likely outcome in Greece for the Greek citizenry? They've gone to the streets. Now they're going to go through an additional belt tightening, additional austerity. And we already see riots and demonstrations against austerity in Italy, in Spain, in Portugal, and in Ireland that does not make any of the mainstream media. What's the likely outcome if things do not change in the next year or two?
Look, every economist alive knows that austerity cannot work. This is not the first austerity imposed on Greece. This is the third round. It's been going on since 2010 or 2011. This is the third round. We know that the first round totally failed. The second round failed even worse. The only effect of the austerity has been to drive down the Greek economy by 27%. That is, depression level decline. When the GDP is driven down, the existing debt becomes a much higher share of GDP. So all the austerity has done for the last 4 years is to make the debt problem worse. And that's what the current round of austerity will do. It will make the debt problem worse because it further suppresses consumer demand, investment demand. It drives the economy down, so the existing debt goes up as a share of GDP.
What is the likely outcome?
So it can't work. It will not work. And the crisis will be back again before us.
Do you believe that Europe will go through something similar to the Arab Spring?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't think so. I believe that before Washington lets the EU unravel and NATO unravel, the European Central Bank will do what the Federal Reserve did. It will use the quantitative easing that it's already undertaking. You know, the European Central Bank is already printing 60 billion euros a month with which to buy up troubled bank assets. And the only reason, as I've already said, that they don't apply this to the Greek debt is because they're trying to use the Greek situation to end the sovereignty of the member states, to take away the ability to have their own fiscal policy.
What I'd like to do is this. We're out of time. We're coming up the end of our program here in a minute. I'd like to invite you back to look at one large question that has not been touched by anyone in the mainstream media, or even for that matter in the alternative media. And that is, where is this all going? We have heard for a long time people talk about the New World Order, the One World Government, and some will say that's a conspiracy nuts, you know, obsession. There is no such thing. But we managed to come across four presidents of the United States and leading people within the different think tanks saying that it would be best to have one ruling power, one currency, one guiding force. So I'd like your thoughts on that when we come back. Also, I believe that NATO is one of the most destructive forces on the planet, should have been completely dismantled. I'd like your thoughts on that at the same time. I'd like to take on NATO. And for people who are wondering, okay, this is just about economics, it's not. Let me give you one last final parting example to this audience. Spain went through a borrowing frenzy, and a lot of that money came from banks in Germany and other countries in France, where they would build an airport. But the trouble is they built an airport an hour and a half away from Madrid that cost $1 billion. It had a tiny little community around it. It was supposed to bring 6,000 new jobs. It was supposed to create a whole new a center of cultivation and living, it brought nothing. This was built, it exists, and it was just sold last week for $10,000. $10,000. And it cost $1 billion. And it didn't create the jobs. In fact, there was only one international flight per day frequently into the airport. But that's what happens during the go-go days when banks were loaded with capacity to print money and loan it out, and people were only too happy to get it for whatever mind-boggling project they did.
That's an example of looting that Perkins talks about in Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Yeah.
Well, that's the reality. I mean, when you hear that a $1 billion airport sold for $10,000 to a group of Chinese investors, you wonder how in the world did anyone ever approve such a thing when it could never have repaid it based upon the income coming in from the airport fees. But that's what we will talk about in our next discussion. We have a lot to talk about. And as always, Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, thank you very much for being with us today.
I enjoyed it. Look forward.
I'm Gary Knoll. We look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day, everyone.